biography of this apostle. And you will see that this man, though he was quite a man of God, struggled with lots of things. And one of the things I am grateful to God for is that the Bible is honest about its heroes. It doesn't try to paint them as people who never struggled, but they are men and women of like passions such as we. There are those who write biographies of great people, or even those who write autobiographies and will conveniently leave out all the bad parts so as to embellish all the good parts. So you'll begin thinking that those people are really better than they are, because you never read the truth. That's far from the way it is in the Bible. You read about its heroes, but you read both sides. We learn that David was a man after God's own heart. How many people could say that? Yet David had his flaws. He even committed adultery with Bathsheba. We have Abraham, the man of faith. But we see that he went down to Egypt and had to lie. He didn't have great of faith as we think at times. He had to tell that person of Egypt, the king, that his wife was his sister because she was so beautiful, even at 90 years old, that he didn't want to have her ripped off by the king. Then there was Jonah, a prophet, had one of the greatest revivals in history, but God had to outwardly, strongly convince him because of his disbelief that he was God's man for the job. And then there's Peter, of course. Peter, that many people look to as the head of the church, though he really wasn't in the New Testament. He was a man who faltered, who disbelieved Jesus Christ, who was the one who said the dumb things at the dumb times and put his sandal in his mouth half the time. And then there's you. And I put all of those together because between David, Abraham, Peter, Jonah, and you, there's probably not much difference. We all have good points and we all have bad points, but we all have areas that God can use in our lives. One of the reasons I don't like halo pictures is because they mislead people. Now, I grew up with pictures in my home, and all of the people in the Bible have little gold things over their heads. They look like little frisbees. And my mother told me they were halos. These were saints of God. And I thought that they were far different from the average Christian until I read the Bible and I found out that wasn't true at all. The word saint, though it's not in our text, describes a person who is set apart by God. Now, we get in our minds the idea that a saint is someone who has died and has been declared by an official group as a saint, or he wears a halo when they take the picture. But a saint is a sinner, revised and edited by God. We tend to think of a saint as someone portrayed in a stained glass window. There was a kid who went to a church and someone was showing him around all of the beautiful stained glass windows and pointed up and said, "That's St. Mark, that's St. Matthew, that's St. Luke, that's St. Paul." That's all he knew. And one of his friends says, "By the way, what is a saint?" When he was at school, and the kid said, "Oh, they're just people that light shines through." But it was a good description. A saint is a person that light shines through, God's light. They're not perfect, they have flaws, but God shines through them. Well, chapter 7 is the struggle of a saint with the law, verses 7 through 25, and today we're going to go from verses 7 through 12. One of the striking characteristics of this section is the change in the way Paul writes. Many personal pronouns. He's not making broad declarations. He's using himself as the example. And he's speaking of his own struggle. In verses 7 through 25, the word I occurs 37 times. The word me, 12 times. The word my, 4 times. The word myself, once. In 19 verses, there are 47 personal pronouns. It's the struggle of a saint with his own sinful nature, and with the law. It's the struggle of a legalist, one who all of his life tried to live under the law. And he's grappling with all sorts of questions. And you know what? I'm glad that Paul struggled with these things. I'm glad. It makes me feel better. It's been said, misery loves company. And there are times where I have struggled with the law, legalism, rules and regulations, what my religion that I grew up with taught about this and how it fits into my thinking now. And I'm glad that Paul struggled with it so that we can relate to him. I looked up in Merriam-Webster the word law. And the definition in the dictionary is a rule that regulates action. And we need certain kinds of laws. There are prohibitive laws that keep us from doing things. There's imperative laws that command us to do things. We need certain kinds of laws. A rule that regulates action. But there is a difference between the law that is necessary and, as a Christian, living under the bondage of law. I'm not speaking about national traffic laws. I'm speaking about spiritual laws, like the Old Testament or even the New Testament. There are those who their approach to worship of God is so much based on rules that regulate actions that that's all they can see is the law. They live under this bondage of you can, you can't, you shalt not all the time. And they go through quite a struggle. The New Testament was filled with legalists outside the church and inside the church. Now remember, when Jesus was around, there was a group called scribes, Pharisees, and Sadducees. In some translations, the word scribes is lawyers or teachers of the law. These were the people who took a spiritual law and complicated it so that you had so many regulations hanging over your head. They were called lawyers, and they're not much different from modern-day lawyers in complicating the law, I think. You know, it's been said that lawyers are the only people in the world who can write a 10,000-word document and call it a brief. Well, there were those religious lawyers in the New Testament who ladened life with rules and regulations. By the way, before we move on, there a note to all of you legalists. You struggle with it. I know you do. You struggle with your legalism. You've set a standard so high, and you demand that you meet the standard and everybody else meets this little legalistic standard either imposed on you from your childhood or by yourself. But you struggle on your own. And because you struggle, you point the finger at many other people who don't match up to your standard. But keep something in mind. Jesus said, among those who bear fruit, there would be those who bear it 30-fold, some 60-fold, and some 100-fold. There's all different degrees of fruitfulness within the church. You may be bearing 100-fold. You're probably not, but you think you are. And you pat yourself on the back while you condemn those who only produce 30-fold. But God gave you a break. You ought to give others a break. Now in verses 7 through 12, he begins with a question by saying, what shall we say then? Is the law sin? Certainly not. On the contrary, I would have not known sin except through the law. I would not have known covetousness unless the law had said, shall not covet. But sin, taking opportunity by the commandment, produced in me all manner of evil desire. For apart from the law, sin was dead. I was alive once without the law, but when the commandment came, sin revived, and I died. And the commandment which was to bring life, I found to bring death. For sin, taking occasion by the commandment, deceived me, and by it it killed me. Therefore, the law is holy. The commandment is holy, just, and good. He begins with a question that people would naturally ask with a legalistic background, which is the law sin? In other words, Paul, what good is the law if all along you're saying we don't need it anymore? It sounds, the way you're talking about it, that you are making the law to be sinful. And he says, on the contrary, or certainly not. Now, I want you to keep a marker here and turn to the book of Philippians for just a moment. As we look at the struggle of a legalist, turn to Philippians chapter 3 because we get Paul's background. He struggled with this because of his own background. And he writes it for us in Philippians chapter 3. He says in verse 3, we are the circumcision who worship God in the Spirit and rejoice in Christ Jesus, and have no confidence in the flesh, though I also might have confidence in the flesh. If anyone else thinks that he might have confidence in the flesh, I do more. Paul is going to give us his background because there were those who were Judaizers. That's a term that means a group that come into the church and were pointing fingers at everybody, telling them to keep the Old Testament law, bragging that they had kept it. Paul says, okay, listen, you want to brag? Let me tell you about my background. I was a legalist. Let me tell you my own spiritual background. I don't want this to be a bragamony, but a testimony. This is what God has done in my life. But let me first give you my background. And he says in verse 5, circumcised the eighth day of the stock of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of the Hebrews, concerning the law, a Pharisee, concerning zeal, persecuting the church, concerning the righteousness which is in the law, blameless. But what things were gained to me, these I have counted loss for Christ. Paul the Apostle was a Jew of high reputation, high standing, with all sorts of privileges and achievements that he had attained, both by what his parents had done and what he had done personally. He was like somebody in the who's who of spirituality among the Jews. And he gives for us his pedigree. First of all, in verse 5, he says he was circumcised the eighth day, being a member of the children of Israel. In a sense, what he is doing is painting for us how religious he was. He was circumcised according to the law. He was Jewish. He was not a half-breed like the Judaizers who were bragging about the keep the law. He said, let me tell you something. I was born Jewish. I kept the law. I was circumcised the eighth day. I was the son of the covenant of Israel. And I leaned hard on that. Just like today, there are many people who brag about their baptism. Not only was I baptized a Christian, I was baptized in this church or that church. And they lean hard on the ritual that they had when they were at birth, being baptized by someone they don't even know today. Or they use the excuse that they grew up in a religious home and have a great set of parents who are spiritual. And they brag on that for standing before God. Paul did too. Next, he says he was a Benjamite, or from the tribe of Benjamin. The tribe of Benjamin meant that you were very respectable among the Jews. Benjamin was the son, one of the sons of Jacob. He was the favorite son of Jacob besides Joseph. Remember his wife when she was dying, Rachel. She was giving birth to her son and she was in such labor, it killed her. She died giving birth to Benjamin. But she said as she was dying, I'm going to call him Benoni, son of my sorrow. And her husband said, no way, I'm calling him Benjamin, Benjamin, son of my right hand, because you, Rachel, have been my right hand all these years. I love you so much. This will be my favorite son now that Joseph is gone. So Benjamin reminded Dad of his wife, Rachel. And to be of the tribe of Benjamin was a high honor. The first king of Israel came from the tribe of Benjamin. His name was Saul. And perhaps that's who Paul was named after. Originally, his name was Saul of Tarsus, probably named after the first king, a Benjamite. When the north and the south kingdoms started fighting in a civil war and falling into idolatry, only the tribe of Benjamin was the holdout and refused to follow the crowd. And so it's like saying, not only am I an American, but I come from the pilgrims. That's my descent. I come from a great background, good stock. I was circumcised, I'm a Benjamite. And then he says, I was a Hebrew of Hebrews. In other words, I was a prominent man. I was a Hebrew born of Hebrew parents. You have to understand that there were many kinds of Jews. There were those who became Jews after they were born. They were born Gentiles, but they proselytized into the Jewish faith by becoming circumcised, promising to keep the rituals. But Paul says, I was born a Hebrew of Hebrew parents. I spoke Hebrew all my life. While many of the other Jews went into captivity and lost their language and lost their customs and became Grecian or Babylonian, I stayed pure with my parents. Then he says he was a Pharisee of the Pharisees. He was a trained Pharisee. The Pharisees, and by the way, there were only about 6,000 of them in the New Testament, were like the spiritual Arnold Schwarzeneggers of Judaism. They were the strong he-men always devoted legalistically to keeping the law. The name Pharisee means separated one. In other words, I'm a cut above you, I'm a Pharisee. You might dabble in normal everyday common life, but I do not. I am not common. I am in the upper echelon elite of the Jewish religion. And they devoted themselves to keeping the details of the law. I mean details of the law. The law said you shall not work. The Pharisees would say, but what does work mean? And so they had all of these sub-areas of what work meant. Do you remember on the Sabbath day, Jesus went with his disciples through the grain fields. And they were just picking heads of grain and munching on them. And all of a sudden, the Pharisees said, why do your disciples do what is not lawful on the Sabbath day? You know, something always has struck me as I read that passage. It's the Sabbath day. They're in Galilee, in the countryside, in the middle of a grain field. Where did the Pharisees come from all of a sudden? What are you guys following us? You should be inside if it's a Sabbath day. All of a sudden, they're eating heads of corn. Boom! Pharisees pop up. Hey, what are you doing? You're not supposed to do that. What were they talking about? Well, according to Jewish law, you cannot winnow, you cannot harvest, you cannot prepare a meal on the Sabbath day. And the disciples were guilty of doing all of that. They were guilty of reaping by plucking heads of corn or grain. They were guilty of threshing by rubbing them together in their hands. They were guilty of winnowing as the chaff separated from the wheat. All of that meant they were preparing a meal. You have done what is not lawful on the Sabbath day. They were so tech about the law and about their legalistic standards that they called the law the fence. It was known as seyag in Hebrew. It is the fence that keeps bad stuff out and good stuff in. And we are the caretakers of that fence. We have set up this fence, the law. We have complicated the law by adding so many restrictions and regulations. And we'll tell you when you cross the line. That's the fence, because we want to keep spiritual cooties away. He was a Pharisee. He was one of this group. Not only that, but notice he says he was a defender of the faith. For he says, concerning zeal, persecuting the church. To a Jewish person, zeal was one of the greatest qualities. And Paul says, okay, you want to talk about being zealous? I killed Christians in my spare time. I brought them into prison. I persecuted them. I was so zealous. I was so into it. And I'm proud, or I was proud at one time, to be this zealous. You know, there were those Jews in Paul's day who were content just being in Jerusalem, hanging out, minding their own business, not Paul the Apostle. He figured that if there are Christians out on the loose that could be hurting Judaism, that's his job. Christians in your neighborhood, who are you going to call? Cult busters. And that was Paul the Apostle. And he would go from Jerusalem to Damascus and haul those Christians into prison who were following Jesus. When Stephen died, and they were throwing stones at him, he was standing at the feet of Stephen, applauding them, egging them on. Then he says about his relationship to the law, verse 6. Concerning the righteousness which is in the law, I was blameless. Not many people could say that. When it comes to keeping the Old Testament law, I kept it. Does that mean he never sinned? No. It means that when he did sin, he brought all of the appropriate sacrifices to the temple to take care of his sin. He lived by externals as a Pharisee. He kept every feast, every ritual. He held his robes in when a Gentile would walk by. He dare not touch a grave. He wouldn't walk over the same ground a non-Jew would walk over. He made sure that he was blameless. Now, there's two kinds of righteousness. There's two kinds of righteousness a person may have even today. One is practical righteousness, where you do everything right. Can anyone in this room say, I've done everything right all my life? And though some try. Then there's positional righteousness, where you rely upon what Jesus did on the cross. You're declared righteous by God, and then God starts changing you from that point on. Paul had to learn the second after he learned the first. And so he wrote about the Jews in Romans 10, saying, brothers, my heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel is that they might be saved. for I bear them witness. They are zealous for God, but it's not a zeal according to knowledge. Since they did not know the righteousness that comes from God and sought to establish their own, they did not submit to God's righteousness. But Christ is the end of the law, that there may be righteousness for everyone who believes. Now look at verse 9 of Philippians. And be found in him, not having my own righteousness, which is from the law, but that which is through faith in Jesus Christ, righteousness which is of God by faith. And folks, that is the weakness of Judaism today. The weakness of Judaism is that it is a righteousness based on personal merit alone. There is no sacrifice today in Jerusalem. There's no Jewish temple where lambs are slaughtered. And yet God said, without the shedding of blood, there is no remission. And so the Jew today will, at the end of the year, at Yom Kippur, will try to balance all of the good deeds they've done that year with all of the bad deeds and hope that the good deeds outweigh the bad deeds. And they'll pat themselves on the back if they've done a good deed or had a good year that could off-balance all of the evil they've done that year. That's the kind of righteousness that Paul said, I used to live under, but now I'm found in him not having my own righteousness. I found out that there is a Chinese character, written character for the word righteousness that comes from combining two characters. This is interesting. One of the characters is lamb. The other character is me or man. And if you combine the characters by putting the lamb character over me, in Chinese it forms the word righteousness. Lamb over me. Here I am standing alone. I put the lamb over me. For some reason why the Chinese chose lamb, I still am uncertain. But that means righteousness. God looks at you as a Christian through rose-colored glasses, through blood-stained lenses. He looks at you through the blood of his Son so that you are not found in your own righteousness, but the righteousness of Jesus Christ as the lamb and his blood is over you. Now, Paul struggled with it because that's his background. Now turn back to Romans 7. Notice a couple points where he talks now about his experience with the law. And keep in mind that Paul had the background of legalism, lived under the law. Now he's a Christian, and he struggled in a period of time with the law. You know, I think after Paul's conversion on his way to Damascus, that he had a long, hard time to think. For 3 days he was blind. He didn't eat. He didn't drink anything. For 3 years he went to Saudi Arabia before he went back to Damascus and Jerusalem all alone. And he probably thought about all of the hard questions of his own religion, thinking, well, how much of it am I to hang on to now? And what about the law and all the rituals I've kept? Do I just throw that out the door? And he comes to some conclusions in chapter 7 about his experience with the law. First of all, in verse 7, he says, the law pronounces sin, or it reveals sin. He says, on the contrary, I would not have known sin except through the law. For I would not have known covetousness unless the law said, you shall not covet. Through the law is the knowledge of sin. That's what it says in chapter 3 of Romans. Let me read it to you in the Phillips translation. It's the straight edge of the law that shows how crooked we are. You know, men by nature are dimly aware of their own sin, though we are aware of other people's sins. We are dimly aware of our own. It's not until a law comes along and says, that's wrong, that you go, oh, really? Something has to be defined as sin before you know it is. If there were no signs that said speed limit 55 miles per hour, you would know it's wrong when you do 80 coming to church Sunday morning. When I was 15 years old, actually I think I was 14 years old, I decided, a friend and I, to take his mother's car and drive it through Los Angeles. Now, I didn't have a driver's license. I shouldn't have driven. I knew that there was a speed limit, and I knew that if I followed that gauge, that I could match that number up with that number on the side, and I'd make it. I'm driving down the freeway through San Bernardino toward Los Angeles, and I see red lights in the mirror. So I pull over. Now, the speed limit was then 65 miles an hour. I was doing, I think, 50, 55. And the policeman says, can I see your license? Now, I'm going to share with you, I was not a believer then, and I lied. I said, I didn't bring it with me, officer. I forgot it. And he looked at me and he said, well, tell you what, I'll check to see if you really have a license when I get back. But do you know that you're breaking the law? I said, no, I didn't. What was I doing wrong? He said, there's a law called impeding traffic. You're going too slow. Imagine that. California freeway, you're going too slow. Not too fast. You're going too slow. That's the crime. You're going 50 miles an hour and the speed limit 65. You're holding traffic up. That's a law, impeding traffic. I have never been guilty from that point on of impeding traffic. I learned my lesson. I had no idea that was even a law or that it was wrong to go too slow until somebody informed me there is a law that says you can impede traffic. Now, Paul's point here is this. The law is like a mirror. It shows that we're dirty. When you look into it, it reveals your true condition. I understand, again, that in California, they had decided to test mirrors in public places. And they put a large mirror on the outside of a public building. They wanted to see how often people, especially in their view, women, would stop by and look at themselves. And they discovered an interesting thing. Men stopped to look at themselves more than any woman. They were interested in their true condition. But the mirror that you look into, either on a public building or in your own bathroom, reveals your true condition, doesn't it? You wake up in the morning and you look in the mirror. Though you might not say it, you think, oh man, whew, look at that hair. I better work on myself. Look at that pimple coming out right there. Better cover it up. The mirror helps you. It doesn't clean you. You never see a person saying, I need to be clean. Take the mirror off and I'll just scrape the dirt off my face. All it does, its purpose, is to show you who you really are. It reveals your true condition. That's what the law does. It shows sin. Then you need to know how to deal with it. We'll go on from there. The example that he uses is coveting, verse 7. He said, for I would not have known covetousness unless the law said, you shall not covet. Why, of all of the sins in the Ten Commandments, did he pick coveting? Why not murdering? Why not stealing? Because covetousness happens right here, folks, inside. You never see it. Covetousness is an inward attitude, not an outward action. And that's his point. The law will show me my motivations, my inward attitudes. That's the purpose of the law. Not just to govern outward action, but inward attitude. Remember, Jesus said, you've heard that it has been said, you shall not murder. I say unto you, if you're angry at your brother, you're a murderer. You've heard that it was said, whoever commits adultery is in grave danger. But I say, whoever looks upon another woman to lust after her in his heart has already committed adultery. He's showing that the law was meant to govern the inward attitude, not just the outward action. Now, I think that as Americans reading this text, it's good. Because I think if there's one of the greatest sins that epitomizes Americans, it's covetousness. Wanting more, enjoying it less. We live life with catcher's gloves on both hands. We want, but not being satisfied. And we don't think of coveting as being wrong, but it is. It's an inward action, and it can lead to greater things. So first of all, the law pronounces sin. Secondly, the law provokes sin. Look at verse 8. But sin, taking opportunity by the commandment, produced in me all manner of evil desire. For apart from the law, sin was dead. I was alive once without the law, but when the commandment came, sin revived and I died. The law provokes sin. You and I have a natural bent toward doing anything that is forbidden by a law. It's the evil nature that you are born with. We have a bent toward it. It's like a magnet that attracts metal. Your old nature is attracted to doing things wrong, and it's provoked anytime there is a law. It's not the fault of the law, it's the fault of the old sinful nature. The law just happens to provoke it. Up by my house, the road is closed. There's this big sign they put out there one day with a ribbon across it. Just a little ribbon with flags. It says, road closed. They were doing construction. I went out there the next day. The ribbon was ripped down. And I saw where the cars had gone up over the curb on the dirt and up on the road. They put the ribbon up again, and they put piles of dirt in the road so you couldn't get over it. The next day I went out, and the piles of dirt had been dug through by tire tracks, and the sign was moved. About 2-3 days later, I saw that the whole sign had been pushed out, a huge sign, by a car that had obviously come through there, hit the sign, and kept going. What is it within us that every time something says, don't do it, we say, I'm going to do it? Why, when it says wet cement, do you find handprints and feet prints in it? Why, when you tell your children, go in any closet but that closet, that's the closet they want to go into? Anytime there is a law, it seems to provoke that evil nature that is within us. We all want to be the exception to the rule. Well, look over at chapter 8 of Romans. Verse 7 gives you the answer. The carnal mind is enmity against God, for it is not subject to the law of God, nor indeed can be. There's a book on my shelf. Everyone ought to read it. Not my book or my copy, but a book like it. Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan. It's an allegory written in the late 1600s, early 1700s. John Bunyan in prison writes of the Christian life. And there's a story of Christian in this book going to a house. And he gets taken into a large room. The door is shut behind him. And it's filled with dust. And there's a guy who tries to sweep the dust with a broom. And all it does is get things worse, dirtier, dustier. And the guy, Christian, almost chokes on it. He said it wasn't until somebody pours water on the floor, coagulates the dirt so it can't rise, that you can take the dirt out. And the analogy he draws is that my heart is like that room. Dust on the floor is like sin in my life, and the broom is like the law. Doesn't really take the dirt out, it just stirs it up. It's not till you take another method of washing away our sins with what Jesus has done that there's really power to live the Christian life. So, if you try to live by legalism, you create more problems. It doesn't make you more spiritual. It can create a more sinful impression in your life. Look at the Galatians for an example. Paul writes to a church that was legalistic. And he says, you bite and you devour one another. Be careful that you don't consume one another. Oh, you're so legalistic, but you're ruining each other. You're pointing the finger at everybody and you're going to wipe each other out. So the law pronounces sin, it provokes sin, and finally it produces death. Verse 9. I was alive once without the law. The commandment came, sin revived, I kicked the bucket, or I died spiritually. And the commandment, which was to bring life, I found to bring death. For sin, taking occasion by the commandment, deceived me, and it killed me. Paul, as a small child, growing up in a Jewish home, learned to love God and to trust God. He didn't know anything about the law. He was just free, probably singing little Jewish songs and clapping his hands and learning who God was and praying until he was 12 years old. At 12 years old, they made him a son of the law, of the Torah. And all of a sudden, he was learning all of the rules, all of the regulations, and he found one thing out all his life from that point on. I can't do it. Though, according to the law, I was blameless, yes. I found that every time I keep a commandment, there's another one. And I keep that one, there's another one. And I keep the ritual, and there's another one next year and next year. And it never ends. I never do enough. And I always have these fingers pointing at me saying, you didn't do this, you need to do that, you haven't done that. He said, it revived sin, and I died. The law produces death. Paul wrote to the Galatians and he said, if a law had been given that could impart life, then righteousness would certainly come by the law. And he wrote again and he said, if righteousness could come by the law, then Jesus Christ died for nothing. Now transfer that to a legalist. If you are trying to get to God by your own merit, by being good, then why did Jesus die for you? Why didn't he just come and spout off a few teachings and then go back into heaven? Why die? Because his death proved that the only entrance to the Father was by through the blood of Jesus Christ. That cleanses you from sin. Not by your own merit that tries to make yourself better. He said Jesus Christ then would have died for no reason. That is why legalistic Christians and legalistic churches never grow and produce fruit. Because the law always produces death, never life. There are some who are so interested in being right that they're dead right. Hey, listen, I'm right. And they'll argue and they'll get legal. And they're dead right. They produce nothing but death. The result, members of that church will judge each other because they've set up this standard. And eventually there'll be splits and more splits. I heard of a man who visited a church in New York City, St. Bartholomew's Episcopal Church in Manhattan on Fifth Street, still there. And he sat up in the front row with a hat on. About 10 minutes before the worship service began, and one of the ushers had just had a tizzy. He said, "There's somebody in our church with a hat on." And he quickly ran over to the men and said, "You got to take your hat off." The men said, "I refuse." And so they waited a few minutes, and finally the head usher came up to him and said, "You take your hat off. This is a house of God." The man said, "I refuse." And so after a little while, the head of the women's committee came by and sternly looked at him and, "You take that hat off, young man." "I'm not going to take it off, ma'am." Finally, the senior warden of the Episcopal Church came by and tried to grab it. He just moved his head and said, "Out of my way." Right as the church service began and the processional started coming from the back of the church, he took his hat off. At the end of the service, they approached him. And they said, "We don't know if you know this or not, but this is an Episcopal church, and according to our beliefs, it is wrong to have a hat on in God's house for worship." He said, "No, I know that. I have been an Episcopal all my life, Episcopalian, and I've come to this church for 3 years now, and I've never met anyone. But today I was able to meet the usher, the head of the women's committee, and the senior warden." Legalism can divide, it can destroy, it can just wipe out the love that is to be in the body of Christ. It produces death, it provokes sin, and it reveals it. What is Paul's conclusion? Well, he says, verse 12, interestingly enough, "Therefore the law is holy, and the commandment is holy, just, and good." You say, "No, wait a minute. You're telling me, Mr. Legalist, that you came from the law and you were found in that righteousness and you exchanged it for God's righteousness? And here you're telling us that the law reveals sin, provokes sin, and kills you, and you're saying it's good?" Yes, it's very good. It served its purpose. Its purpose was to show you are dead without Christ's help, so that you will be driven to Jesus Christ. The commandment is holy, it's just, it's good. And you see, I can't do it all on my own. I failed. Well, the commandment is holy, just, and good because it reveals God's will. It's the expression of His will. Yeah, but you say it reveals dirt. Good. Get it washed by Jesus' blood. But it says the law kills. Well, it better not live by it then. It should cause you to come to Jesus Christ for newness of life. You might ask at this point, why would God give Israel a law they could never keep? To show Israel the sinfulness of their own nature, to drive them to life. Charles Spurgeon wrote these words, "I do not believe that any man can preach the gospel who does not preach the law. The law is the needle, and you cannot draw the silken thread of the gospel through a man's heart unless you first send the needle of the law to make its way for it. If men do not understand the law, they will not feel that they are sinners. They will never value the sin offering. There is no healing a man until the law has wounded the man, not making him alive. And he is not alive until this law has slain him, and then he can come to Christ." Remember that the Pharisees created this fence we were talking about, the siag. They were so proud of the fence. The problem is it kept so many people out. Like the disciples. "Hey, you picked grain on the Sabbath, you're out of the fence. And so many people back then felt they were not included because they didn't meet the standard. Like that story of that French cemetery, run by a religious person. A soldier had died. The comrades had brought the body to the churchyard, wanting the comrade to be buried in that churchyard. And the man who kept it said, "Is your friend a Catholic?" He said, "No, he's not. We don't know if he is or not. We know he loved God, but we don't know if he's... I'm sorry, I'd like to bury him in the churchyard, but church rules prohibit him unless he can be proved that he's Catholic. He cannot be buried in this churchyard." So, outside of the fence, they dug a hole, and the comrades buried their soldier friend, covered it over with dirt, went to bed that night, got up the next morning to check on the grave, and they couldn't find it. They looked and they looked and they just couldn't find it. And they finally went to the priest, and the priest said, "Well, I didn't get much sleep last night after our conversation. And knowing that he could not be buried in the churchyard, I just simply went out last night and I moved the fence to include the body of your friend." That's God's grace. Here's the fence. You can't get in it. Oh, we'll move it. Now you're included. Legalism builds a fence. The gospel rips it down and includes even you. Heavenly Father, I pray that we would be driven to Jesus Christ and His grace. That as we look at the law of the Old Testament, or we look at even the laws that Christians around us push up as being the standard of righteousness, that we'd look and say, "Oh man, that produces death, that provokes sin." And we would be driven to a whole new way of life based in motivation on our love and dedication to You. That would say, "I want to obey Jesus Christ because I love Him, not because there's a law that says do this and don't do that." Lord, set free any of us who have come from a background of legalism or are struggling even within the church now to be brought under the bondage of legalism. Paul struggled with it. It killed him. But he said it was good. I pray that the law would drive us to Jesus Christ and we'd be found in Him. Instead of relying upon our rites and our rituals and our backgrounds and our baptisms and our church memberships, we would come to You. In Jesus' name, amen.